Hey, Kate.
Hi, Ryan. It's Kate.
Oh, is it? I was worried it was somebody else. Someone
I
had
know.
hijacked into your Skype and
A
kind
girl
of
can dream.
ruse.
So, for the first time in a while, we've decided to really not plan.
Which may come as a surprise to some folks.
So
Deep
I'm pretty
sigh.
sure, Frankie swallowed a Band-Aid.
Oh, good.
So
That's what's
that's
on your
where my
mind.
mind is at right now.
Whether your child is going to survive.
Whether my child is going to shit fire on her way to releasing a Band-Aid. She's going to gently release the Band-Aid.
God. One day Frankie's going to listen to these.
No, she won't. Frankie, if you're listening to this sometime in the future, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for my mediocrity. Just in general, I'm sorry for any resent. This is fun. Let's make this a time capsule letter
Yes.
to my disinterested teenage daughter. I think about that frequently.
Frankie
Like
listening
what?
to this?
No, just like what is it about me that's gonna piss her off?
Oh, sure.
You know, 'cause I think we all have things about our caretakers that piss us off. And I just, you know, you can't, I don't think you can know.
Yeah.
But I try.
But you try.
I went to the dentist yesterday.
That's exciting.
I always think about yoga when I think about the dentist. And I always think about the dentist when I think about yoga. I don't know why. I think it's one of the only analogies I have that it's just like it's in a it's the comparison, the bridge between the two is just so true for me. You know, like when I'm practicing, it is a dull throb and it is the removal of calcification. That's what I think of. It is the water pick. It's like the
Sure, yeah, I got you. I got you.
And I don't know that that's the most skillful way to approach my practice, but it's how I practice. Like everything is about removing calcification or stickiness and like thinking about how a coral reef is formed and like how that's beautiful, but when it starts to form, it hardens in your mouth and it hardens in your body.
Sure.
I don't know. I don't know that it's always good to approach a yoga practice as if you're trying to like. I think about what you say about, you know, the first thing you want to do is get out of pain or is reduce or eliminate, you know, the obvious sources of suffering that you can in the body, and then you get to do some work.
Sure. Though it may be some considerable amount of work to. Because it's never like you can eliminate the suffering in the body, per se. But it's more of a. There's sort of a cycle of quieting and then addressing the sort of real pains and sort of immediate needs of the body. And then there might be some inquiry that can start to take place. But it's such a difficult thing because in order to describe practice, we have to speak as if it's happening in some sort of linear form because there's no other way to speak. but in reality, it's not actually unfolding in a linear way. Necessarily. I mean, it is both unfolding in a linear way and not. It's unfolding in a linear way in the fact that time is progressing.
Your time is, in fact, passing.
Yes. But the way that we speak about practice doesn't reflect the... even the instructions we give about practice doesn't actually reflect the internal process that's taking place. Which is a fundamental flaw of, you know, a group class. You get lots of benefits from it, but, you know, if you only are engaged in group classes, like, that becomes the expectation of practice. And the sort of myriad of possibilities and sensations and moods and emotions that arise when you're trying to practice on your own is like, and how you deal with them how you work with them fundamentally more interesting for me. And then trying to describe what's going on in that context to a group of folks is like it's so fucking hard. Because there's the like, okay, is the language accurate to my experience? And then how can I communicate this to a group of folks who clearly can't have my experience because it's my experience and not theirs? Like, and then, you know, yeah, so it's just, the whole thing is flawed. So let's just quit.
Yeah. Now, I had that thought when I was in the class. I was taking class with a very gifted teacher who was very skillfully and artfully describing something subtle and mellow. And I had this moment of, yes, I'm experiencing sensation in a particular part of my body in this shape. And then I was like, but there's no guarantee that anybody else in this room is, and therefore we should all quit. Because it's like we stand up in front of the room as if we're about to give a recipe for making a birthday cake.
Yeah.
As if we all have access to the same equipment and materials.
Yeah.
An interest in building a birthday cake.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Now I just want cake.
My God, I do too. Frankie's birthday's coming up, which, what?
Yeah.
A, but B, I think I'm going to make a cake.
You're going to make a cake?
I'm going to make a cake.
That's very exciting.
There's a heaviness to this first birthday for me because I desire to create an experience that I can replicate for the rest of my life for her, even if she's nowhere near me.
Sure.
So whatever it is that I do on this inaugural birthday, I have to sustain for the rest of our time together on this planet.
I think you're putting maybe a little too much pressure on yourself.
This is who I am. This is how I live. It's exhausting. So yeah, I'm totally doing exactly that, but This is what it's like to be inside of this freaking Rube Goldberg machine. So yeah, I'm thinking like, what thing am I gonna do?
Bake a cake.
Yeah, but what kind? It's not important. It's super important, but it's been tying in even this to how I've been approaching teaching and practicing. yoga. Like, there's, like, we should be having more conversations with psychologists, just like as a group of people, as a group of quote unquote yoga teachers. Because I think that there can be this pressure to create subtle pathos in every class, you know, like, and to experience it in every practice.
Yeah, which to me is never actually the point.
It's like there has to be duende everywhere.
Well, there has to, there's a, so there's a fine line between trying to work with the truth that it is possible to use the skills that you've garnered in yoga practice to make a, you know, I don't necessarily want to use the word therapeutic, but more, because I don't really mean it in that way, but I mean more that if you are feeling X and you don't want to feel X, you could utilize the skills that you learned in yoga practice to affect change in a skillful way, right? Like, that is a thing you can do. I feel pain in my lower back. I can breathe and move and pay attention to the sensations in my body in a way that, you know, ends in a temporary reduction of pain. And then also leave room for the fact that there are instances where that isn't possible. And that if you're unsuccessful, quote unquote, meaning that you don't feel a reduction of pain after practicing yoga, that there's, you still had a successful yoga practice potentially, if you could talk about a yoga practice as being successful. Does that?
Yeah.
Like, there is, like, yes, you can have an intention for practice, and at the end of practice, there, your, the outcome of practice might be rather congruent with your intention. But if it isn't congruent with your intention, then it doesn't mean that you practice was in some way a failure.
All right, fun question. What makes a successful practice?
Just the fact that you get on the mat or cushion for the period of time that you intended to get on the mat or cushion. And you paid attention to your experience. Yeah. I think so. Because saying much more than that lays out potentially a set of goals which are, first of all, not universal. And second of all, I don't, you know, one of the things that can happen in class is you get that sort of buildup of the group energy of the room, and then there is this sort of release and this relief that happens at the end of class that I don't want to discount in any way, shape, or form, but that's not always what practice on my own feels like. Like, there are aspects of that, but then there are also aspects of frustration. There are aspects of the lack of, you know, coming face to face with a lack of clarity, or even just like, you know, the part of yourself that's just like you wish you could just like snap your fingers and, you know, be able to bend over backwards and grab your ankles, and then the part of you that wishes that you could snap your fingers and, you know, get rid of any sort of physical discomfort that you have. And, you know, there's all sorts of layers of shit that comes up in practice, and that still might culminate, that still might end in a moment of relief. But there's just a very different, there's a different mechanism going on when it's self-directed. Which is not to say that you're not quote-unquote practicing when you're in a group class, because that's what I think is the mark of quote-unquote, I mean, successful is a really problematic term here, but like, you did a good yoga practice if you went to a class and stayed for the whole class. Like, that is a complete yoga practice, unless there was something so untenable about the yoga class that you were taking that you, for your own safety or sanity, had to get up and leave that classroom, in which case that is also a good yoga practice, because you were paying attention to your experience enough to know that the skillful thing to do was to get up and leave.
Yeah. Just, I think whenever we start having conversations wherein one of us says to the other, "What are we doing? I think we need to quit. Just quit." We
so
quit.
Every day of the year.
I feel like it coincides with like, oh, it's been some time since having a break. Well, which is true for me, not so true for you.
Yeah, not so true for me.
So what's the news in the in the meditation Shambhala world?
Oh, I don't know. I've taken a pretty big step away from all that. Which is not to say that, you know, if things change that I might not step back in, but I think they're in the process of appointing an interim board of directors. I'm just going to choose another board of directors. I noticed that the committee for the interim, whatever it's being called, is all female. If I recall correctly, I could be incorrect about that, but it was at least predominantly. You know, I really wish everybody who is in that community the best, and I really hope that at the end, or at some point along all of this, it becomes clear that they are really kind of forging a path forward in a really exciting way. It is, to borrow a phrase that they would use, that's not my path. It's just not. I think the talking about path is problematic within Buddhist circles because it's just kind of ends up being code word for sort of more culty language. I think I said this on the other podcast, that the thing of value, when I really look at it, is Buddhism. And there's not enough there that is uniquely Shambhala for me to think that I need to be a part of this shift or transition in anything other than a mildly supportive character sort of way. And I think that's fine. I think that's fine. Because that's always just been sort of like one aspect of practice. Like, it doesn't actually encompass the whole of practice for me. Like, there's stuff missing. And the quicker that we can admit that, like, whether we're talking about Buddhism or whether we're talking about Kashmir Shaivism or whether we're talking about Hatha Yoga or whether we're talking about Judaism or whether we're talking, like, whatever it is, no one has the full picture because they couldn't possibly have anticipated the truth of relativity of this culture right now. You know what I mean? So, and in general, especially in the realm of you know, yoga, Buddhism, etc. There's so much of the teachings about sort of living in the world are couched in a lot of either a culture that was entirely monastic or a culture that was entirely engrossed by a caste system, or like it actually becomes hard to separate out what those teachings are separate from the culture in which they were originally
imbued.
So I think yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of meh about it at this point. Just kind of in a I will keep practicing the things that I find valuable to practice, and then that seems to lead me in a generally positive direction, so I will continue to do that. End of story. Sorry, I wish I had a more exciting viewpoint.
So how's burnout going?
I don't know. I'm actually feeling pretty good today. I'm getting ready for the restorative immersion next week, which is fun. And I don't know, it's nice to have, like, obviously this material is material that I've been teaching for, like, a really long time at this point. So, it's always fun to plan it, because I do already know like the vague outline, but as I start to plan, there's always sort of new things that come about in planning and prepping. And like, I don't know, that's what I want to be doing with my time. is planning and prepping an educational experience and then executing it to the best of my ability. That is something that I fundamentally enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah, I for sure do too.
Because you're doing a lot of that as well now.
Yeah, I had a hunch that was going to be something that I loved.
A hunch.
You know, and I had definitely done enough presenting of materials, but now in the context of teacher trainings, I really adore it, and it is deeply challenging, like in a really good way. You know, people bring feedback and questions that can't be anticipated, and if you're offering something that's like spacious enough to have some exchange in there, it's awesome. Like,
yeah,
I will say though, my gosh, in terms of the it's important to have recovery time afterwards though.
Yes, ma'am.
I remember, you know, being around you and Lynn after your long teaching days, and you guys were always bitching and moaning, and I was like, I believe them, but I don't really get it.
Now you get it.
Now I'm like, oh, because it's not 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah.
It's not hours in equals this amount of residue effort-wise, this amount of napping required afterwards. There is a directly proportional and inverse relationship that goes through a crazy algorithm, and you know, it just exponentially compounds itself. Long story short, after I did this most recent one, I went directly to the mountains of New Hampshire and was a ghost. I was a ghost. I haunted my family. I was present in body, haunting them.
Yes.
But, you know, that has to be factored in when one thinks about, like, okay, so it takes this long to do this, but it takes this long and then this long afterwards to recover.
Yeah. I'm actually, the training is the 6th through the 10th, and then I leave on, which is Monday through Friday, and then I leave on Saturday afternoon for P-Town. So I planned this rather purposefully.
That's awesome. That's smart.
But I still am doing, because of that, I'm still doing the thing that I know that I shouldn't be doing, which is teaching all of my other classes in, in addition to 5 hours of teaching a day. So, you know, that'll be interesting, but then I'll be in P-Town, one of my favorite places. And we'll have a grand old time, I'm sure.
I went to the, how long are you staying for?
A week.
Jeez.
It is my roommate's 30th, so.
Okay.
It's a whole thing. Whole thing.
This week I went to a concert. I haven't been to a concert in a while. That's not true. I go to concerts a lot. But I haven't been to an outdoor concert in a while that I didn't necessarily want to go to. I should have given it that caveat. Anyways, I was at David Byrne.
Oh, yeah.
And, Nick was like, it's going to be an awesome show. And I was like, all right, let's go.
Would you care to tell the listeners who David Byrne is?
He's a Scottish-American singer, songwriter, musician, record producer, artist, writer. He was the founding member and the recognizable voice of the Talking Heads.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, I love the talking heads, and I grew up
listening to the Talking Heads. Absolutely, my dad used to listen to them all the time.
Yeah, and I enjoy David Byrne, but I wasn't particularly like looking forward to this concert. It's just, I was a little tired, and just you know, I don't drink anymore, and concerts like require like an exegesis of energy that I. But anyways, I really fucking loved it. He is such a brilliant and strange artist.
Yes. Yes, he is.
And he was doing some interesting and challenging things on the stage. And I plan on incorporating some of his new music into my yoga classes, which, much to the chagrin of attendees.
I thought you were going to say you were going to integrate some of the things he was doing on stage into yoga classes.
Oh, he's just such a bad dancer. It's crazy. And I had somebody next to me that was like really excited to be there. It was a fella and his wife, and I think they were my age-ish, and he just kept bumping into me and being like, "Oh, this is so great. Isn't this great? Do you want a drink? Isn't this great?" And I was like, "Yeah, this is awesome. No, I'm all set. Thank you." And then at one point, like, he turned over to me with like a vaporizer and was like, "You want some?" And I'm like, "No, I'm good." And like, I'm like, he's like, this dude has been kindly and generously offering me stuff. It felt like a fish show, you know, to him.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
But it's David Byrne. So it was like, that was the other thing. The cross section of the population that was at this show.
Oh, I'm sure.
Felt like half of them were there for Yanni and half of them were there for fish. And then there was like some Leonard Skinner fans in it. Like, I didn't understand the demographic.
Yeah.
I don't get it. What I do know is that I think, although I'm not sure, I think I saw people I went to high school with there. And I immediately was like, shit, I live too close to where I went to high school. I gotta go. I can't enjoy the show because what if they sit down next to me and I have to make small talk? I don't want to make small talk. But these were people I used to go to shows with all the time. Like, I used to go to fish shows a lot. But there also felt like there were Ani DeFranco fans there. I don't know.
I haven't been to a concert in ages. I would like to get back to a point where I was going to concerts again. That would be fantastic.
I feel like any time I resist going and then go, I'm like, I'm so glad I went. I really needed to be in the presence of somebody performing, or I needed to be in the presence of art in some way. Like, it's so easy to just be like, no, no, no. But then you go and you're a fucking better person afterwards.
Yeah. I agree. This is a really exciting episode.
I know. This is definitely our best.
By far. I'm just going to name the episode that. The best unrolled ever.
Oh, God. Can I, here's something that's been happening to me in yoga class lately, and I'd love your opinion on what to do about it.
KK.
So I've been taking class, and at least 4 to 5 times during class, I get to the place where I'm on the verge of falling asleep, and I have the full body spasm.
Like, while you're in triangle pose, or like...
No, well, it's... While I'm
on the floor, okay.
Lying on the floor. As soon as I'm on the floor, give me 4 minutes, and I'm going to have that spasm.
Yeah. It's the, I'm forgetting the technical name of it, but your body for a moment interprets that you're falling through space, and in order to stop that falling through space, it jerks. Is that the experience?
Yeah.
I'm totally blanking on the name of that. It'll come to me eventually. There's like a technical name.
Hypnic. It's the hypnic jerk. Myoclonic.
Myoclonic. Yeah. Well, I mean, you could go the route of just like inclining yourself every time you do a supine position. Because there is something to the, like, the angle of your body, like, the closer you get to supine, the more likely, the sleep cycle, it doesn't begin, like, in full, but, like, that the hormones start to shift towards that. So, especially if you are already exhausted, which most of us are, sometimes, but you know, that was when I was teaching more like regular restorative classes at Beck Bay, I did find that to be the case with a few folks, and this is something that I got from Judith, that like if you know, if someone was sort of habitually falling asleep or habitually falling asleep to the point of snoring and they were sort of embarrassed about it, that to instead of doing something like Shavasana to put them in more of like a seated reclining pose, like the lazy boy kind of setup, that they would be reliably less likely to fall asleep being on that upward incline. You know, it's not foolproof, but it's a worthwhile experiment, I think.
Okay, that's interesting. I also have moments where I'm like, does this mean I shouldn't be practicing? Does this mean I should be napping?
Yes, but if practice is the thing that gets you moderately close to a nap, like if you wouldn't nap otherwise... Like, that's often what I come to is, like, yeah, I should probably just nap right now, but I'm not going to be able to get myself to nap right now because I'm too consumed with what all of the shit that I have to do. So I'm going to get on my yoga mat, and I'm going to move around a little bit, and then I'm going to do a restorative pose, and, you know, maybe I'll fall asleep, but it'll be, like, I don't know.
I like that. It's what you're talking about is a permissive space to at least rest.
Exactly. And that's the other thing. And for me, especially, like, naps are not a pleasant, restful experience for me. Because I do not in any way, shape, or form want to duplicate the grumpiness that occurs when I get out of bed in the morning. The idea of doing that twice in one day is terrifying. Like, I just don't want to do that. And I don't want to subject anybody that has to be around me for that, you know, 30 minutes of just hatred.
What's that about?
I don't know. It's just always been that way. I am the grumpiest person in the world when I wake up in the morning. And it's not even really having to do with caffeine, like, because I could go without caffeine. There's just, like, this cycle of, like, it takes about 30 minutes for me to be, like, okay with interacting with another human being. So, napping is something that I try to avoid at all costs. But resting in a restorative pose for 20 minutes, that feels restful and rejuvenating and... I don't wake up grumpy after that. So I don't know what that is.
That is really interesting, and I bet hormonal.
I think of it as a public service. I don't want to subject anybody in the world or in the studio to me waking up from an actual nap.
Nick's like that when he wakes up in the morning, like, I mean, we're still together after almost 10 years, but like, it's best just not to exchange anything with him until like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's like night and day. It's terrifying. Like, some of the most shitty things come out of his mouth. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? And then, yeah, like 2 seconds later, you know, once that's worn off, he'll come into the kitchen and be totally like lovely.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
So it's very real, I think, and I bet it's a thing.
I bet it's a thing too. It is, in fact, a thing. But I don't know what the mechanism of the thing is, but it's definitely a thing.
Anyways, I get afraid. I get afraid in class sometimes that I'm going to fall asleep and wake myself up burping or farting or something. And I think maybe I need to just find a motel that lets you rent by the hour. And I need to go in there and sleep.
Yeah.
But as you said, part of the beauty of going to a class is it's just guaranteed that I will at least have been off of my phone, off of the computer, out of a caretaking role for, you know, yeah, an hour.
Yeah.
So do we think yoga is going to start getting better in Boston ever again?
That's a big question.
Let's not zero in on Boston.
Just in life?
Let's just pull back. Is this a result of the fact that I've now been teaching for the amount of time I have, and this is just what everybody who's been teaching this long thinks?
It's quite possible that that's starting to happen, and, you know, welcome. No, I think it's... trying to think how to say this kindly. If I really taught, not saying lead people through an experience of, but if I actually taught folks the things that I think are valuable in terms of practice, it would honestly probably result in the most boring yoga class ever. Because to be honest, yoga's kind of boring. Like, purposefully so. And I get great benefit from that. And especially when, I think it was today's Friday. So last Wednesday, I had a recurrence of pain in my neck, which hasn't happened in years, but it was one of those, like, oh, I know this one. This one, I've done this one before. This is a thing that I'm quite familiar with. In the same way that when my forearms start acting up again, it very much mimics the same sort of pain presentation of when I had tendonitis years ago. And so I was able to pretty successfully, like, manage and even reduce and relieve the pain. You know, it was still quite a prominent tension pattern that was there, but the work that I was doing to relieve that was not these sort of like quick fix therapeutic things. It was really objectively boring. Like, and like made no choreographic sense from, you know, if you were going to try and take that and mold it into some expectation of what, you know, what a yoga class would look like. And so, you know, I was able to sort of still use that as inspiration for something that looked like a yoga class, but it was by no means could I have taught, like, step by step what I did to work with that. So, like, I don't know what good yoga looks like if it's got to be in the context of the capitalist model that we've hooked ourselves into. Because it would be, you know, I've been to classes that look like what I think like when I've been to New York and gone to Amy Matthews, like, group class, and I don't know if she still teaches this class, but she used to teach a class at Yoga Union in New York City, just like a Tuesday afternoon, like, 2-hour class or something like that. And I went to it a few times. And it was everything that I thought, like, a sort of modern expression of yoga should be. We, like, did a thing, or she sat up in front of the room, she explains a particular concept, then we did a couple of things. Very sort of like mind-body centering mixed with something that someone might recognize as yoga asana. And then we would, like, stop and, like, discuss it. Like, what your experience, what everyone's experience was. And then we move on and do something else. And then we might do a yoga pose. And then rest at the end of it. Like, but the people in that room, those are a very self-selecting group of folks. Like, if someone else came into that class, it'd be like, what the fuck is going on?
What is going on here?
So, like, I have a sense of what that would look. It's sort of what I'm trying to do in the 2-hour class that I teach at Bo on the weekends. But you still, it would be very different for me to try and do that at another studio. You know, it would be very, very different. So, like, I don't know what... I don't know what yoga, quote-unquote, getting better would look like. I just don't. And on a broad scale. I know how, like, I am obviously trying to get better and better and better at sharing my experience of yoga with folks in a way that I feel is productive and useful. But, like, in terms of, like, the culture around yoga, like, I don't know. To me, I always wrap my brain around some sort of clarity of purpose. That discussion seems to be lacking. Like, if there's a class that's purpose is sweat and thereby fitness, then that's totally fine to me as long as it's not trying to say it's something else or something deeper than that. Like, someone might have a deep experience in that or a cathartic experience in that. I think that's what most people find from the sweaty, challenging classes, is this, like, catharsis of having finished a quote-unquote yoga workout. But, like, there can be really these like, hard contradictions to hold in terms of, like, is everything okay the way it is, or do I need to push my body to get my foot behind my head? Like, which one of those two things is true? Are they both true? Or am I really supposed to be leaning into attempting to get my foot behind my head? Or is attempting to get my foot behind my head just like a red herring and this idea of the body being fundamentally intelligent, myself being fundamentally having some sort of fundamental human intelligence, is that the thing that I'm supposed to be practicing? And this other stuff over here is just like whatever on the side. You know, like having a really nuanced conversation about that sometimes I feel like is and because yoga is inherently subjective, it's not that I'm advocating for there to be one answer. It's just that I'm advocating that we are as accurate as possible about what our viewpoint is. And then trying to, you know, consistently examine that viewpoint and examine the way that we're teaching and examine the way that we're practicing to be like, oh, is that really my viewpoint? Or is there some, like, subtle fucked up shit lurking in there that I need to unpack? Like,
you know, be gentle, don't bail. Be gentle, don't bail.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's room for that toggle, right?
Like, and it is a toggle. It is a fucking toggle. That is exactly the word.
Yeah, there's room for that back and forth. And within that back and forth, you might find what's actually skillful in the moment. But if it's the attitude behind the don't bail that is interesting to me, and the attitude between the be gentle. If the attitude behind the don't bail is like, I'm a shitty person, so I gotta push through, or is the attitude, huh, you know what, this is something that I avoid, so I'm going to try to lean in a little bit.
Why do you avoid it, though? That question is always barking at the heels of this is something that the habit is the why. And that's where it comes into, like, oh, Jesus, we're starting to go into the deep end.
Yeah. Well, but that's exactly. So the, you know, one of the things, like, very classically in Buddhist teachings, there's this idea, specifically in Tibetan Buddhist teachings, there's this idea of Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana being sort of like these three. They're always presented as sort of like stages, but they really are kind of, they're intermingled more than that. Hinayana meaning that sort of personal liberation, Mahayana meaning more of this idea of sort of the idea of the bodhisattva, the fact that, you know, you're sort of foregoing your personal liberation because you realize that personal liberation is pointless if you're not bringing everybody along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vajrayana meaning that, oh, I could do this now, as opposed to, like, next lifetime. And the sort of expedited path that lays out. But the thing that my teacher always talks about as, like, the first aspect of any of that is just, like, what's your habit? Like, before there can be any talk of all of that, like, what's your fucking habit? Like, what is the thing that you're habitually doing? And some people would say that that's part of the Hinayana teachings, but to me it's really helpful to just be like, especially when you're talking about what, like, your viewpoint of the whole situation is, to be like, not in terms of habit being good or bad, but just in terms of recognizing that, like, oh, that's just my habitual way of thinking about things. That habitual way might be fundamentally useful, but it also might not be. So it's just that, like, staring, like, the habit right in the face. Am I always trying to push, do the next fancy thing? Or am I always, like, stepping on the brake? Why am I stepping on the brake all the time? What part of that is fundamentally intelligent, and what part of that is just not? Like, what part of that is confused? And it's not like there's a need to, like, fixate around a clear answer, but just to, it's almost like cultivating enough space to realize, oh, wait a second, why am I doing this? Am I sure that I want to put my elbows into my armpits and lift my feet off the floor? What's the point of this? And, like, that would be a really awkward way to teach Bakasana. Hey, everybody, here's how you do Bakasana. Now, first, is this something you actually fucking want to do? Why do you want to do it? You know what? You are not allowed to do it unless you can give me a reason. Like, and the reason can't be because I said so. Because, like, the person at the front of the room said so. Why do you want to do it? And if the answer is just, I don't know, or I want to try, like, that's a perfectly fine answer.
So this is really, you're hitting on something. What if we did that?
What if we actually did that? Like, here's the thing that's possible that someone taught me how to do. Here's why I don't really do it anymore. Is it something that you want to do? Like, because if it's not, then it's just not something that, which is not to say that down the line it might not be something that you want to try. You know what I mean? Like, it's got to be more of a, transparent dialogue. Like, headstands may be a better example. Like, I don't know that I still practice a headstand maybe once a week, but, like, I would be lying if I said that part of that is because someone told me that that's something that I'm supposed to be able to do and I have some attachment to it.
Or care about, yeah.
And I would also be lying if I said it didn't, when executed well, seem to have some unique positive effects. Not as many as people necessarily claim it does, but, like, there are some things that I get from headstand that I couldn't get from other inversions. Especially when I execute it in what feels like a balanced way. Do I think that it's something that I want people to learn how to do? I don't know anymore. It's not I don't know anymore. No, I don't think that it's useful to teach folks. Like, if no one had told me that I should stand in my head, I probably wouldn't have done it. And there's not enough, like, unique positive effects that I'm gonna go around saying that, like, you need to stand on your head. Now, that would be a very different conversation if someone came to me and said, I would really like to learn how to headstand. And then we could have a conversation about it.
Yeah, so why might that be? Question number one, why might that be?
Exactly, why would you want to And, you know, if we came to an agreement on, like, a path forward to teach this person how to do a headstand, then we might very well execute that. But the hope would be that in executing that, it would really be more about, as Leslie and Amy and, you know, many other people have said, like, the path, the things you learn on the way to being able to stand on your head or to stand on your hands or stand on your forearms, way more valuable than the actual act of standing on your head. Like, the process of learning how to do that is just way more valuable. And so I do teach aspects of that in class, of, like, things that I practiced in order to learn how to do that, but I don't explicitly state it as a headstand prep anymore. I just state it as, okay, we're going to do this thing now. Like, that's all. So, but that involves having some sort of dialogue like that. That just takes time and patience, which is certainly something that I hope that I've, and think that I've cultivated through yoga practice. But, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, Bow Street's always an exception here, but if I went to some other studio and hopped in to teach a 6:15 class for somebody, and I stopped in the middle and tried to have that kind of a conversation, like, there might be some people who really appreciate it, but there might also be some people that are like, what the fuck?
Well, mostly I think that what we're doing when we start to even toe dip into that in a public class is the unspoken or spoken implication that that's something you might want to try at home or outside of this room, in or outside of the context of yoga. Like, for me, it's just this, like, maybe we do this, maybe we don't. All of those languaging around ambiguity and permissiveness, and I've been talking a lot about Montessori style yoga. My hope is not even what literally happens in the classroom right then and there, but the idea that, hey, what if you just started thinking this way about everything in your life?
Yeah, yeah. But here's the tricky thing with permissiveness, though. So a friend of mine who had not gone to a public class in, like, a really, really, really long time, let's say. They were on a retreat thing where they weren't the only teacher, and took the asana classes that were going on, by some of the other teachers. And one of the things he commented on was, like, the, like, do this, do that type of attitude, basically. Like, you could do this, or maybe you do that, or maybe you go this way, or maybe you go that way. And obviously, I agree to that. Like, there is that attitude is right on, but I think the execution of it is often lazy on the part of teachers. Because there's often not a clear conversation of, if you are making a choice, what is the outcome that you feel? Not maybe do this, maybe do that, try this, try that, but, okay, you're in... I don't know, I'm trying to think of a good example here. Let's say you're in a... I don't know what people call it. Do people still call it, like, a crescent lunge or something like that when the back knee is off the floor? Or what is, or a high lunge or whatever?
Yeah, crescent when the knee is lifted.
And the spine is up away from the floor, like in a vertical.
Yeah, like Warrior One, but you're on the ball
of the feet. Yeah. I mean, that's how I talk about it, but I don't know how folks are speaking about things these days. So if you bend your back knee, if you make the choice to bend your back knee, what do you feel? If you make the choice to straighten your back knee, what do you feel? If you lean the torso backwards, accentuating the bend of the lower back, what do you feel? If you change the overhead position of the arms, what is the outcome of that? Now, do you have to walk through every single choice that could be made? No, but there has to be some... We're not just making choices for the sake of making choices unless we're trying to actually go through the variables and like discover every, like take inventory of what the choices are, which is a valuable exercise unto itself. But I'm more interested in people being able to, yes, make a choice about how they are aligning through the bones, engaging the muscles, releasing the muscles, what have you, but that they're also clear about what the outcome is in that moment. So that we're building this like sort of data of like, oh, if I bend my back knee, I'm noticing that I'm not so much in a, not as much in a back bend as I am if I've straightened it. Okay, that's an interesting thought. Okay, but it's a little much pressure. It's a little too much pressure on my knee, so maybe I straighten it a little bit, but keep it mildly bent. Like, to just be able to pump in the posture, as opposed to like, it's either you're doing this or you're doing that, is something that's really hard to teach. And I feel like is the permissiveness can... what's the word I'm looking for? Sometimes discount the conversation around the meaning of sensation. So if there's not like okay, so I guess a better way to think about it is it just creates, sometimes it just creates a different arbitrary set of alignment rules. Does that make sense?
Well, it can set up a reaffirming of existing patterns.
Yes, absolutely.
It can be like, oh, okay, they're doing this thing where they're giving me this choice. I'm going to do the thing I always do because fuck it.
Yeah. So, you know, and that's fundamentally the reason why I'm interested in, you know, studying my, you know, how my body works from an anatomical point of view, is so that there's a clear understanding of what all of the choices are. And then I can start to sort of play the choices as if they were scales and be able to notice what the outcome is. Like, it's interesting to take your arms overhead and forward bend your wrist and notice what the different effects you can get by changing the angle of your wrist forward, back, side, side. It's interesting to notice that actually it's okay to bend your elbows when the arms are overhead because you can get a different leverage on the muscles of your back when the elbows are bent than you can when they're straight. Like, you can absolutely draw your shoulder blades together or spread your shoulder blades apart because it's just different. And you can feel different things and you can experience different things. Now, of course, when you start to do more and more complex and compound shapes, you know, some of those choices become ill-advised. But that's just why I don't teach super compound shapes, is because I want to practice and teach a more simple subset of postures where all of those things could be explored.
I don't know. I think it's important to in choice and making those, having the opportunity to make some of those choices in class for some people is like the first place where they start to cultivate their own practice.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying, I'm just saying that like the choice has to be given.
Well, it has to be given well, Ryan, because otherwise I've been in classes where it's like, well, you know, just do what feels good.
Exactly. That's
do you
the
do
thing
this?
That I'm talking about.
And but here I want to defend even that, because the teacher that does that, it's still space, you know. And if the person in the room is like, well, I just been given a whole pile of nothing, I'm gonna make a choice, and that's valuable too, you know. It's a flawed mouthpiece, but we're all terrifically flawed mouthpieces. Like, there are ways to do it in a way that feels super intentional and like you're continuing to deliver value even when you're not making express choices for every freaking body in that room. And I try to skate that line, but there are times where I'm like, no, really, honestly, I'm not inside of your body. You're welcome. I'm not inside you.
Yeah.
What makes sense? How does it feel? Oh, by the way, you might have made the wrong decision. It's okay. Now try the other one out. Eh?
Yeah.
What?
But that, even that is more, that's a lot more than do what feels good. Because then there's also the conversation of like, which is sometimes beyond the scope of a public class. Like, well, what if what feels good is part of a habitual pattern?
I know.
Like, what if, you know, pushing yourself to your edge is being translated as feeling good?
Oh, you know what else used to feel really good? Like, the amount that I used to drink felt real good. It's true. So yeah. It's the measurement of pleasure that's an interesting, yardstick.
Yeah.
So using another word, like what is useful?
Yeah.
Might be useful.
But even that, like what we're getting to is like the context in which most yoga is practiced nowadays is fundamentally not conducive to those type of conversations. Like, we're doing the best we can, but it would, in that context, a lot has to be left out.
Yeah, and that's why I think I'm starting to feel what I'm starting to feel.
Yeah.
And yet I still completely value it.
Yes.
You and I are both still in a place of optimism.
Yeah. As much as it might sound like we're not.
I know. I'm still in a place of, well, yeah, this is flawed. This is a flawed premise. Let's work within it still.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in the back of your mind, you talk about this whenever you touch on capitalism. There's always just that moment of like, well, I'm going to go to my authentic place. I'm going to snuggle up against it. And I'm also going to look around and make sure that I can put food on the table.
Yeah, exactly. Which is
what prevents us from filling a room with trampolines.
Yeah.
And bubbles and saying, just go, be, let's do something different.
Yeah, yeah.
Yoga. Which is not what I would do, by the way, but.
Yeah, sure. Maybe the bubbles, though.
Oh, God. Bubbles.
Maybe the maybe not the trampolines, but maybe the bubbles.
So hear me out on this. This is just a final mini topic thought before we hit the 2-hour mark with what had begun as a shitty unrolled and sort of became interesting. Did it? I think it did. Did it?
I don't think that's for you to decide.
No, absolutely not. But okay, so hear me out. I've been taking it's not like a baby yoga class. It's like a crawlers class. It's about movement and stuff. But honestly, there is something about taking that class that is like the most informative of my...
of your week.
Of my... it's like one of the most important... like the, seeing movement and exchanges and surprise through Frankie's eyes in this class is like, oh, that's the... yeah, yeah. So there isn't one recognizable moment of asana in the class.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm grateful for, because I have real mixed feelings on kids yoga.
Yeah.
Big time. Like, they're already doing it. Leave them be.
Absolutely.
But, and this isn't kids yoga. This is, like, a different thing. But, like, watching the approach of, like, it being a experiment in movement and balance and breath and just being there with other people, seeing what it is to be alive... that to me is like, oh, that's what I want my class.
Yeah, yeah.
So I should bring out bubbles like right before Shavasana and blow them.
Sure. I think that's a good plan. I think that's a good that's a homework. That's a homework assignment.
Fuck you.
For everybody. Bubbles all around.
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, this has been unrolled.
This has been unrolled.
I'm exhausted. I'm gonna go have a hypnic jerk.
I can't believe that y'all made it this far, but I'm super grateful that you did. You can find us on Unrolled at Unrolled Podcast at various places on the social medias, and you can check out our Patreon, or you check out our website, unrollpodcast.com, which will lead you to our Patreon, where if you find it in your heart to make a monthly contribution, there are buttons for you to do that there. Please, as always, send us questions and comments, and we will be happy to address them on the podcast. Wow, I'm really running out of steam. Kate, take us home.
We love you for listening. Thank you. If you made it this far, connect with us. We're here. And Godspeed.
Godspeed.
Bye!
Bye!